Hello, and welcome to episode number 86 of the Point of Convergence podcast. As always, I am your host, Exoacademian. Throughout the history of humankind, we've been pushing the boundaries of exploration, determined to map and often eventually populate every nook and cranny of physical space we come across. This has meant we've ventured into every corner of the Earth, even those sporting the most inhospitable of environmental conditions. When the modern-day UFO phenomenon first exploded into public consciousness around the era of the 1940s, through not one but a series of remarkable events, that orientation around frontier consciousness led almost everyone of the time, once it was clear these strange objects seen, designated UFOs or unidentified flying objects, were very unlikely to be of prosaic origin, to assume that these apparently intelligently controlled vehicles must be coming from the last of the frontiers we had yet to explore, namely outer space, that greater expanse of the surrounding cosmos. This, of course, suggested the existence of extraterrestrials, beings who had evolved on different planets in entirely different star systems in far-flung corners of the Milky Way galaxy or beyond. This sparked our imagination, leading us to imagine what they might look like and how they might behave. Would they look anything like us? Would they follow our behavior patterns? Would they want to conquer and colonize us the same way we'd done with each other? As the 20th century marched on, many people around the planet began to report encounters with the very beings supposedly piloting these sophisticated vehicles. Interestingly, while modern science had long leaned towards extraterrestrial beings looking decidedly unlike us, because of their origin being tied to completely different evolutionary pressures in completely different home planet contexts, the reports arising from these encounters with otherworldly beings, quote-unquote, spoke to remarkably humanoid form, and indeed on regular occasion, even a seemingly fully human form. Furthermore, even the types less human in appearance still matched the general morphology of other forms of life from Earth, including reptilian and insectoid types, including mantis beings even, bearing a striking resemblance to 9-foot-tall praying mantis insects found right here on our home planet. Of course, this raises an obvious question. Why? Why were these encountered forms flying in the face of our expectations around what extraterrestrial beings would look like, and more importantly, what they would not look like? I would suggest to you that perhaps the issue lies in one of our earlier assumptions, that the next frontier to be explored is always spatial in nature. But what if these others were not coming from elsewhere, but from some other, yet poorly understood, non-spatial dimension? On that note, the notion of a multiverse opened up the interdimensional hypothesis to popular consideration. And that's still in the running, suggesting these beings are arriving from planes of existence sitting in parallel to our physical existence. But there is another possibility that has long escaped the mainstream of our collective imagination around these particular beings, namely time travel. In other words, what if these beings are not so much coming from somewhere else, but rather some when else? When one stops to consider this possibility, not only does it hold its own in terms of serving as a potential theoretical explanatory mechanism, but it also fits remarkably well with key components of the historical data, not just around the appearance and behavior of these various beings, but also with other key elements arising from the historical experiencer literature. This possibility that time is a key variable in the overarching phenomenon is a fascinating one, one that will be our focus in this, the 86th episode of the Point of Convergence podcast. As we begin this week's episode, I would just like to remind everyone that if you'd like to get access to all of my content, including not just the Point of Convergence episodes and Liminal Frames episodes, but bonus material I create, such as OTC Squared, Off the Cuff, and Off the Cusp is what that stands for, and various feature series I also create about different topics, as well as access to my private Discord server, etc., then you can do so by becoming a patron on patreon.com/exoacademian or by subscribing on Spotify. That would give you access to all of the material, all of the content I create. Okay, moving on to this week's episode. First of all, I want to make a point about the overarching phenomenon, or what we colloquially call the phenomenon. First of all, I think it's important to say that my working hypothesis is that we still have more than one group involved with us here on the Earth. Indeed, many, many different types of origin sources, I would suggest. And within each of those, perhaps we have different groups. For instance, what we're going to discuss today will involve a certain kind of hypothesis that gives an origin explanation for some of these beings. And I want to make clear that even amongst this one narrow focus of a type of being we're going to talk about today, beings that perhaps are coming through time rather than from somewhere else, or at least that time is the key element, because of course, space-time is one integrated fabric. So if they're coming through time, they're also coming through space. And because the Earth is a moving object, in fact, our entire solar system is moving, then that also means that they are coming through space as well. But the primary element is time. But again, even there amongst the groups that are coming through, I think we see evidence in the data for different types of groups, different factions, even of the same kinds of groups. This is part of the complexity here. I also want to point out that what's interesting when you think about the total data to do with the UFO phenomenon, it's always good to look for patterns within the totality, because we sometimes conflate and collapse all of the data, assuming that we will find one origin source and one agenda for the entire enterprise. And I think personally, that's where we go wrong. I think when we look at the data, we actually can identify patterns within it, sub-patterns that speak to a specific historical enterprise being conducted by specific beings. And again, that's what we're going to speak to today, because I think much of what we're going to discuss today has to do with events that happened in the 20th moving into the 21st century, and especially towards the latter half of the 20th century. Of course, that said, I would be remiss to not also mention that once time travel enters the picture, even if it began by entering at a certain point in linear time, or what we experience as linear time, then as it gets perfected, then perhaps you go back further and further. And so what is the original or the first example gets confusing, because when it actually entered a certain timeline is one issue, but how it ends up impacting the entire timeline, or perhaps creating multiple timelines, is another issue entirely. That's part of the complexity here, especially because we've been so conditioned to think in terms of linear time, and much of our expectations will be stretched here. And that's perhaps why this hypothesis hasn't gained more traction in the mainstream, because apparent paradoxes prevent people from really taking it seriously and perhaps looking at the data through this lens. But once you move past those paradoxes, and I think we can once we really think through what's really going on here, then actually, again, this is a very good fit for a certain specific aspect of the totality of the phenomenon, a very specific, seemingly historical enterprise involving certain kinds of beings and morphologies that almost match to a T forms already existing on the Earth, or they are at least, even to the naked eye, seemingly examples of further evolutionary trajectories involving forms, types that already exist right here on our home planet. In today's episode, we'll be relying largely on Mike Masters' work, Dr. Mike Masters, who is a biological anthropologist and paleoanthropologist, also a friend of mine. He's written several books on this issue of time travel and its relation to the UFO phenomenon. The book we're going to focus on today is The Extratempestrial Model. He also has a new book out called Revelation, The Future Human Past, which is written as fiction. But you might ask yourself whether or not writing it as fiction allows for a certain kind of artistic license to tackle some of these tricky topics. But I highly recommend you check out that book too. But today we're going to focus on The Extratempestrial Model, the second of the three books he's written on this matter of time travel, on the matter of these being future humans, perhaps, that we are encountering. Now, first of all, before we kick off here, because I'm thinking about some of you might be very eager to hear this hypothesis, others might be not so open to it because you're so connected to this being extraterrestrials or ultra-terrestrials or interdimensionals or something else. I just want to say, be self-aware about which hypotheses resonate with you and why. This is a self-awareness check here, because we always want to be searching for, trying to be aware of, making ourselves aware of potential bias in our response to this phenomenon, in our delving into this data. Now, in previous episodes, I've also touched on this topic, the extratempestrial model or the extratempestrial hypothesis, the notion that these are beings actually coming from our future. And yes, indeed, that would make them our descendants. Now, in previous episodes, I focused on the likely biological connection these beings have with us based on their morphology. And we've gone into that in great detail. We will touch on that briefly in a moment. But mainly what I want to focus on today is largely what Mike Masters focuses on in this second book, The Extratempestrial Model, which is the other elements of the historical narrative that fit really well with the notion that these are future humans coming back, perhaps trying to change something in the timeline. Now, again, can you change timelines? That's something we'll get into. That's a complex matter. But what's interesting about this book is he takes different case studies of historical events that have involved the UFO phenomenon, even some of our most well-known ones, but looking at it from the lens of the extratempestrial model. In other words, looking at what was reported as happening in those events, the kinds of beings that were described, the kinds of behaviors that were described, the ways the craft were described, the ways that the hybridization and biological examination seems so front and center. When you look at that through the lens of the extratempestrial model, especially when we tie to that certain revelations these beings have provided to different experiencers around why they're doing it, then suddenly it begins to make a lot of sense. So much so, in fact, that it makes us wonder, makes me wonder anyway, if perhaps this has been hiding in plain sight all along, and perhaps, again, bringing up that word bias, that's all that's prevented us from seeing this as the best fit for the data, especially, again, for a certain segment of the data to do with events we look back on in the 20th century. Okay, so let's jump into the book. First of all, again, I just want to touch on the fact that the morphology, the similarities between us and them are remarkable, especially when you're a biological anthropologist like Mike Masters, who has a specialty in the hominid line. He looks at them and looks at us and sees two types that must be connected, genetically connected, along an evolutionary trajectory. Quoting from the book here, quote, "As mentioned above, it is improbable that extraterrestrial aliens would evolve to look or act like us. The odds are very low that another two-legged, upright walking hominin with two eyes, a nose, a mouth, five digits on each hand and foot, and an enlarged brain and neurocranium would evolve again in a separate solar system. It is even less likely when considering the specific environmental and biocultural factors that culminated in our complex condition, making our species unique among the plethora of other organisms on this planet." Unquote. So key points there. Number one, we share many things in common with them, and perhaps we're so familiar with these details because we see each other all the time that we kind of miss the remarkable aspect there, that these beings look so much like us. They have a head with two eyes, a nose, some semblance of a mouth and ears. They have two arms, two legs, bipedal in nature, all of these things that they share in common with us in terms of a humanoid form. And again, that's just looking at what we call the grays. There are also many encounters with even more human-looking beings. And again, we'll get into how perhaps that suggests these beings are from different points along the timeline. And the ones that look most like us are coming from the near future, the ones that look the least like us coming from the most distant future. That actually, again, makes a lot of sense once you start thinking about it. But that's the biological similarity, which again, you cannot look past. But once you do, as I said, as we're going to do in this episode, in different case studies, examining the actual data in terms of what they were doing, what was happening, and the things they said to experiencers, again, suddenly it makes a lot of sense when you look at it through the extratempestrial model lens, and when you think about the reasons that are perhaps given as to why they would be conducting these kinds of affairs. Now, in regards to that last point, again, I want to say this, as an experiencer, as someone who is representing other experiencers, championing experiencers, again, some people will not want to take into account the historical data around what has been communicated to experiencers in terms of messages that these beings have for us as Earthlings and messages they have about why they came here, what they're doing here, and perhaps when they came from. All of these elements are in the historical literature if we will pay attention to it. Some people of the nuts and bolts variety will refuse to, but that is, I think, a foolhardy way to approach this. This is a rich historical narrative. This is a data set. This is something we should definitely take into consideration when we formulate our hypotheses. Mike Masters has done that here, and I applaud him for his efforts. Again, he's in a very unique position to not only have a background in biological anthropology, but he's also taking seriously the accounts that experiencers provide in terms of what they hear from these other beings. And again, that is credit to him because some people simply ignore it. But this is a rich part of the historical literature, the historical data. And then when you take all of that into consideration, this does emerge, I think, as a leading hypothesis. Again, for this aspect of the data, this sub-pattern within the totality, I think this is the best fit for the data we're looking at today, the data we're considering, even the data that's part of the John Mack archives, which of course I'm very interested in. Now, before we move into some of the historical cases that we'll consider that will also, again, I think, support this notion that they could be extraterrestrials, let's first consider their clandestine nature. Why do they hide so much? Why don't they land on the White House lawn and announce their presence if they are extraterrestrials from Alpha Centauri or some other far-flung location? This is what Masters has to say about that. Quote, if extraterrestrial beings did happen to locate us and traverse vast distances to get here, we might expect some formal introduction upon their arrival. Still, the approach of the visitors thus far has been etic in nature, with no formal contact or announcement of their presence in our times. It is hard to fathom why extraterrestrials from a distant star system would zip around our skies and oceans and occasionally perform covert medical examinations on us, then return home without introducing themselves. This scenario seems far more paradoxical than one in which our distant descendants return to investigate their own past, while avoiding overt contact for fear of disrupting our social order or the entire timeline, unquote. Again, I think that's a compelling argument. When you think about their clandestine nature, yes, they could be following some sort of prime directive. That's possible. But then why do we see so much of them while they're also supposedly following that prime directive? It's the combination of the two that I think is the compelling argument leaning towards the notion that they're here and showing themselves only as much as they need to, and they mostly are trying to hide because this is a covert enterprise, because they do not want most of us to know why they're here, and they don't want to impact the timeline by broadcasting both their presence and their origin to us. Now again, furthering that point, I've seen some people interested in this topic who assume that they're ETs, being frustrated by the fact that these beings don't tell us who they are and where they're coming from and why they're here. Some people see this as signs of malicious intent, inherently malicious intent, because of the silence. But I think this is a good example. Whether or not this is the appropriate hypothesis and is proven to be correct in the long run or not, that we have to be careful when we leap to conclusions like that. Because if it's true that, for instance, in a case like this, they might be concerned with polluting the timeline, changing the very timeline that could impact their future, not to mention aspects of our own future, that they would be cautious, reticent about how they interact with us. So silence and clandestine activities don't necessarily imply nefarious intent. Now, one of the first case studies we're going to look at here involves a man named Udo Wirtanen from 1940 in Montana. This is something Udo said afterwards regarding his encounter. Quote, he was a nice-looking man, seemingly about my age. He wore a light gray pair of overalls, a hat of the same material on his head, and on his feet were slippers or moccasins. His English was like mine, but he spoke slowly as if he were a linguist and had to pick his way, unquote. So this is interesting. Again, people attached to the ET hypothesis will say, well, they're just casting that impression on people. They don't really look like human beings. They're just doing that to make him feel more comfortable. Or again, if people assume nefarious intent, then they assume this perhaps implies they're trying to fool him. It's a ruse while they try to manipulate him for some sort of nefarious purpose. But again, another way to look at it is just at face value, that he saw someone that looked like a man, enough like a man that he didn't really even notice anything hugely different, except for the way that he spoke English. He spoke English, but he seemed to be picking his words as if he was a linguist. So we can imagine here again, following this lens of the extraterrestrial model, perhaps this is an anthropologist, someone who's studied languages, ancient languages even, and managed to master them to a certain degree, but not like a native speaker. But it allowed him to at least carry on a conversation with Udo. And the next element I want to get to is the technological nature of these craft. This is something else to consider here. Again, when people conflate and collapse all of the data, they assume that this is all about some third realm, some beings coming from some place, some dimension that's not really physical in nature, perhaps flying craft that only look like craft, but that are actually more like something else, something magical, something non-physical in a way. But what's clear in many of these encounters, again, from this particular aspect of the literature, these are very technological craft. And we're going to see that in how Udo describes his encounter with the craft itself. I want to quote from the book again here. Quote, "Once inside, Wartina noticed that the pervasive humming sound he heard outside was no longer audible. When he asked about the sound, the man not only told him where it came from and how it related to powering the ship, but according to Warren Aston's 1998 research, Wartina was given what appeared to be a full and open discussion of the key principle involved in the following words. Quote, as you noticed, we are floating above the ground. And though the ground slopes, the ship is level. There are in the outside rim two flywheels, one turning one way and the other in the opposite direction. He explained that this gives the ship its own gravitation, or rather overcomes the gravitational pull of the Earth and other planets, the sun and stars, and through the pull of the stars and planets to ride on like you do when you sail on ice." Unquote. Again, this is just to address the fact that this is a technological vehicle. This is not some sort of light form that is just looking like a physical craft. Clearly, we are seeing elements of technology here, advanced technology. And now we're going to learn about how this specific kind of technology could actually be used for something like time travel. Quoting from the book again, quote, "High electromagnetic fields are frequently detected in and around UFOs and places where they had recently been. It is also common for cars, radios, and other devices to become increasingly erratic and completely shut off as a UAP approaches. The prevalence of these reports suggests the electromagnetic force is integral to the operation of these machines. The fundamental force may also be a part of how these travelers manipulate space-time to return to the past and how they withstand the tremendous G-forces generated in association with the incredibly fast accelerations and decelerations observed, as will be discussed later in the text. There is already some indication that electromagnetism could be a valuable tool in our pervasive fight against gravity in aeronautic engineering. Its future significance in anti-gravity propulsion systems may be implicit in the immense differences between the electromagnetic and gravitational forces. In fact, according to Dr. Clifford Johnson, a professor in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Southern California, we tend to think of gravity as very strong. After all, it's what binds us to the Earth. But actually, of all the forces we know in nature, gravity's the weakest. Let me give you a number. It's 10 to the power 40 times weaker than electromagnetism. That's a one with 40 zeros after it." Unquote. And then referring to this difference in the two strengths, Masters goes on to say that, quote, "it may also aid in constructing a device capable of bending and warping space-time to allow time travel to the past. Manipulating the electromagnetic force could be a key component in creating closed time-like curves, CTC. By bending space-time to the extent that light cones become reoriented toward the past, amplifying the electromagnetic force could help create CTCs without having to maneuver masses equivalent to that of a black hole, which may otherwise be needed to achieve the same level of space-time warpage using the force of gravity. The form and observed capabilities of UAPs, considered alongside reports of close encounters detailing the components and inner workings of these craft, like that of Udo Wartina, indicate our species may eventually harness the awesome power of the electromagnetic force. This may allow our proximate descendants the ability to advance aeronautic propulsion and our more distant descendants to eventually develop backward time travel technology." Unquote. Now, moving beyond the technology piece, we're going to talk about the actual encounters and sometimes the reproductive encounters. And they're not always clinical in nature. Sometimes it actually involves full-on sexual intercourse between beings that are somehow compatible enough that this seems possible. We're going to look at the case of Antonio Villa-Boa, and this happened in Brazil in 1957. This is something Antonio Villa-Boa said about his encounter with a particular female kind of entity. Quote, "I was flabbergasted and not without good reason. The woman was stark naked as I was. Moreover, she was beautiful, though of a different type from the women I had known." Unquote. Now, just to clarify, in this account, Villaboa was led inside the ship by these two figures, human-looking figures, and taken to this inner chamber where then a naked female figure that looked mostly human came in. There were some differences about her, but definitely he was aroused and they had supposedly sexual intercourse, as the story goes. Now, how would this happen with alien beings, with extraterrestrial beings specifically? Likely not possible. This is what Masters says about this particular case. Quote, numerous aspects of Villaboa's account suggest these individuals were human and likely humans from the not-too-distant future. Their temporal proximity is indicated by Villaboa's description of the woman that seduced him, who had only slightly more derived features, which are entirely consistent with traits delineating the hominin clade. Additionally, they both possess the requisite anatomy for having sex with each other. And though Brazil has less stringent rules against bestiality, there are no indications that Villaboa copulated with another species. It is patently possible to copulate with any variety of animals, though we are not usually attracted to ones different from ourselves, regardless of how much aphrodisiac, antiseptic, viscous, clear, odorous liquid is rubbed on our bodies. Additionally, beyond mere physical attraction or the functional capacity for copulation, using projecting phalluses and recessed vaginas, which life forms who evolved on other planets may not have, the basic ability for two organisms to reproduce viable offspring has long been the gold standard used to determine whether they are the same species. Simply stated, the biological species concept, BSC, asserts that if two separate organisms can mate, reproduce, and produce viable offspring, meaning their offspring are also able to reproduce, then they are considered the same species, unquote. Now again, as Masters points out in that situation, that particular case, Villaboa was perhaps interacting with beings not from the too distant future, and so sexual intercourse of that kind was possible because they hadn't changed much from our current morphology. Now, with the more distant ones, temporally speaking anyway, often different kinds of techniques are used, but ultimately it's still used to actually produce hybrid beings, which again suggests that the same root species is involved. All right, now we're going to jump ahead to another element that actually supports the notion that the extraterrestrial model is the best explanation for this actual component of the data. We're going to look at a case that happened in 1977 involving Corporal Armando Valdez, and this happened in Pampa, Uscuma, Chile. Now, what's interesting about this case, perhaps telling about this case, is that we see actual differences in time, local time, between Valdez and his experience versus his men that were in the area. Again, this gives evidence supporting this notion that they are actually manipulating time and that abductees are often put through a different experience of time. In other words, their local experience of time is different than the other humans that they are returned to afterwards. So at this point, Valdez and his men see a mysterious object, and now we're going to pick up when Valdez approaches it. Quote, Valdez said a quick prayer and ordered the light to leave, as if it were a soldier under his command. Because it was not, and it didn't leave, Valdez next demanded that the object identify itself. When this tactic also failed, he began walking toward the object again. But as he drew nearer, Corporal Valdez suddenly disappeared from sight. Because the bright violet light had been illuminating the entire area, his men could plainly see that he did not simply disappear into the darkness, but instead he vanished entirely. This caused confusion and consternation amongst the six soldiers who were watching intently as Valdez marched towards the peculiar craft. According to his men, about 15 minutes after Corporal Valdez disappeared, he abruptly reappeared. However, he looked entirely different from the last time they saw him. In fact, in a matter of only 15 minutes, Valdez went from being a strong, imposing military officer to appearing frail, weak, and extremely unsteady on his feet. Then in an almost trance-like state, as if channeling the visitors inside the craft, he said, quote, "You don't know who we are or where we come from, but we will be back soon." Valdez then lost consciousness, fell to the ground, and didn't wake up again until 7 in the morning. When he came to a few hours after passing out near the craft, Corporal Valdez was aware that something had happened, but he was unsure what had transpired, since the last thing he remembered was walking toward the strange object earlier that morning. That is where the story takes an interesting turn. as Valdez looked down to check his watch, rather than showing April 25th, which was the actual date, it instead read April 30th, 5 days in the future. This suggests that Corporal Armando Valdez was near or perhaps on this ship for 5 days, even though from the standpoint of his men, only 15 minutes had passed between the time he disappeared and then reappeared in a haggard state. Similar to the Travis Walton abduction, the passage of these missing 5 days was corroborated by excess beard growth on Valdez's face, which according to his men was clearly shaven prior to the incident. Unquote. And then just jumping ahead a couple paragraphs, quote, "It is possible that Valdez was abducted and his memory of the encounter was wiped clean prior to his return, which is extremely common across abductions, although it is also possible that when he approached this craft and entered a radius in which the space-time metric was modified for the visitor's own purposes, Valdez experienced their speed of time, and no longer the one he had previously shared with his men just moments prior. This would also help explain why Valdez appeared to have disappeared, given that if he entered a space in which time moves at a much different speed, he would no longer share a mutual now with his men. In the same way you can't see someone standing in front of you who had been there yesterday or who will be there tomorrow, Valdez's men could no longer see him as part of their four-dimensional reality, as he was still in that same place, but suddenly at a different time. Experiencing some form of space-time distortion in and around UAPs is exceedingly common, and additional examples will be presented in other case studies as well. The ubiquity with which space-time is warped in the area around these craft is also indicated by a recent GQ magazine interview with Lou Elizondo, who headed the Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program, ATIP, an unclassified but unpublicized organization set up by the U.S. government to study UFOs. While discussing how frequently pilots see and interact with UAPs in the air, he mentions that it is also common for them to experience alterations in the passage of time while in close proximity to these machines. Quoting again from what Lou Elizondo said here, quote, "And then you might get somebody who gets really close and says, 'You know, Lou, it's really bizarre. It felt like I was there for only 5 minutes, but when I looked at my watch, 30 minutes went by. But I only used 5 minutes worth of fuel. How is that possible?' Well, there's a reason for that, we believe, and it probably has to do with warping of space-time. And the closer you get to one of these vehicles, the more you may begin to experience space-time relative to the vehicle and the environment. Current hypothesis is that it creates a bubble around it, and that bubble is insulating itself from the space-time that all of us experience. And so therefore, the way it experiences space-time within the bubble is fundamentally different from outside the bubble." Unquote. And in considering this case further, Masters says, quote, "The visitor's apparent ability to manipulate space-time and the resulting divergence in the rate with which time passes in their reference frame relative to our own may also explain how they can accelerate and decelerate at tremendous speed without dying. These incredible maneuvers would surely generate massive G-forces. However, if these visitors are in fact altering the speed of time in and around their UFOs, then what we see as a 75G acceleration may feel like a slow 1G acceleration to them inside the ship. Rather than thinking of these seemingly impossible accelerations and decelerations as a real-time phenomenon and questioning how any biological entity aboard could withstand the insane G-forces generated, the Valdez experience leads one to wonder if it is only an illusion resulting from the divergent way in which we see them and they see us in different temporal reference frames. If Valdez did experience the passage of 5 days over the course of 15 minutes, it may help explain his physical condition once he reappeared. Not eating or drinking for 120 hours would naturally make someone very weak. And while people can die within 3 days of not having any water, death from dehydration typically takes closer to 10 days, depending on factors like age, activity level, and overall health. Valdez's extreme weakness and fatigue also could have been exacerbated by standing too close to the operative object, since similar symptoms are common across such accounts." Unquote. Now, as we know, encounters on board craft after having experienced an abduction often involve biological examinations, and the extraction of sperm and egg to be used within some sort of overarching hybridization program. This is a key aspect of the data. It is front and center. It is a feature, not a bug. The question is, why would space aliens be doing this? Would it even be possible for them to do it? And furthermore, why would they so often express to the human beings that were being abducted that it was essential that this happened, that it was part of some overarching enterprise that was of the greatest importance? This was not just some random scientific experiment gathering specimens as an ET species traveled around the cosmos. This seems to be something much more specific, connected again to our future. Now, to touch on this aspect, we're going to look at the case of Terry Lovelace, which we actually covered in two different podcast episodes on Point of Convergence. This is what Masters has to say in discussing the Lovelace case. Quote, "Occupational specialization is apparent across contact cases, and it may exist as part of a much larger collaborative operation. For instance, during one of Terry Lovelace's 4 to 5 abductions, he was taken aboard a large triangular craft where he recalled seeing numerous specialized human groups exhibiting diverse physical characteristics who were carrying out different but coordinated tasks. This included one group that would line up abducted people, strip them naked, and take them into rooms that stretched as far as he could see. While we can't know what was happening inside these rooms from this part of Lovelace's account, based on countless other abductee reports, the people who were stripped naked were most likely subjected to a biomedical examination, which also involved sperm and egg extractions. Evidence of the latter, as well as the results of this ubiquitous practice of taking gametes from people during UFO abductions, can be seen in the fact that Terry Lovelace and his friend Toby were also subjected to this practice of sperm withdrawal, and from what Lovelace saw lining the walls of this massive triangular craft." And then we're going to quote what actually Lovelace said here. Quote, "There was a crowd of people too, 50 or 60, a lot of people. Some of the human beings were crew members. They just ignored us. They marched us past a long wall of aquariums. There are big fish tanks, 100 or more aquariums. They cover a whole wall. There is pink water inside and some are bigger. They look like, no, bleep, no. These are human beings, but no, they can't be living human beings. They're different. Oh God, they're not like us. One moved its head and turned towards us. His eyes blinked and oh bleep, no," unquote. Now, we're very familiar with these kinds of situations where not only alien beings, what are supposed to be alien beings, are on board craft, greys and insectoid types, and even mantid beings and whatnot, of reptilians, etc. We also very often see beings that look like everyday humans, humans you might find in our contemporary time. Now, this could indicate cooperation with military groups. That's very possible. In fact, I think that probably is part of what's going on. But in addition, they may be humans from our near future, and this might indicate an overarching enterprise where humans, or at least descendants from the same hominin line, are working together in some sort of overarching enterprise. And when we see different beings, different forms, different morphology, it might just be the same root species, but represented along different points along the trajectory of our evolutionary path. Now, in terms of what is often observed in abduction cases or contact cases or even sighting cases, there's another aspect that we can consider here from within this extratempestrial model. We notice often that there is a silence and a stillness when a UFO is present. What does this suggest? Why is suddenly everything silent? Why are birds and insects suddenly not heard, not a peep is heard, when a UFO is nearby? What does this suggest? Again, Masters points to the fact that this could be an indication of space-time manipulation. Quoting from the book again, quote, "As discussed in the Corporal Armando Valdez case study, one explanation for the sweeping calm often observed by contactees and abductees is that these vehicles are capable of warping space-time in their proximate vicinity. The differential rate of time's passage near these ships creates the sense that time inside this bubble has slowed or ceased entirely relative to the outside world, since no movement means no sound. This may also help explain why the ship Linda Jones observed appeared to fade in and out of existence while it engineered the timescape around them." During a keynote lecture at the 2021 Anomalous Aerospace Phenomena Conference, sponsored by the Scientific Coalition for UAP Studies, noted American engineer Dr. Harold Hal Puthoff drew on his 2010 paper titled Advanced Space Propulsion Based on Vacuum Space-Time Metric Engineering, as well as a book by Paul Hill, former chief scientist at NASA Langley Research Center, titled Unconventional Flying Objects. During his presentation, Dr. Puthoff contended that the utter silence and missing time experienced by so many contactees and abductees may be related to space-time metric engineering, which he considers an important part of the functional capabilities of these craft. And quoting from what Puthoff said here, quote, basically, if you are able to change the temporal aspect of your surrounding space, you can either speed it up or slow it down. The reports that often come forth, people say, well, there I was close to a craft, and suddenly all the sounds of nature, the birds, the wind, you know, I didn't hear a thing. Well, if time has been slowed down in that area and has gone into infrasonic so that you wouldn't hear it, that's one of the elements that you would expect to experience. So then you would also obviously have kinds of things where you would interpret it as missing time, because suddenly if time got slowed down, so maybe you might be, let's say, in the craft's vicinity, slowed down for 5 minutes. Meanwhile, outside, several hours have gone by. By then you emerge, you say, oh my gosh, I've got missing time. It might not be that you actually missed any subjective time. It's just one of the consequences of space-time metric engineering. And then Masters goes on to say, the visitor's ability to engineer the space-time metric could also help explain other observed aspects of these craft and their flight characteristics, including how a roughly 30-ton ship can withstand estimated accelerations ranging from 100 Gs to thousands of Gs and travel through our atmosphere at upwards of 9,000 miles per hour with no sonic booms, air disturbances, or evidence of excessive heat, while also displaying trans-medium capabilities, as these seamlessly move from air to water and back again. Space-time metric engineering may also help explain the bright lights so often seen emanating from these ships, as well as why people who get too close to them report suffering from sunburn-like injuries indicative of radiation damage, which would happen if the electromagnetic spectrum is blue-shifted in association with the space-time metric engineering. Dr. Puthoff also addressed these issues in his 2021 presentation, and quoting from Puthoff here, quote, under the conditions with which the space-time metric has been engineered to produce the kinds of effects you might expect to see with a UAP, you get blue shift, which means, first of all, some of that infrared is going to be upshifted into the visible part of the spectrum, so you expect craft to be quite bright, which is one of the things that is in fact reported. With this blue shift, there is prediction of near-field exposure injuries. For example, the visible can be blue-shifted up into the UV and you get sunburn injuries, often reported by people who claim to have encountered a powered-up craft at relatively close range. Or if you're too close, it can even, some of that visible spectrum, which ordinarily isn't harmful, can be shifted up into the soft X-ray region and you get radiation injury. Unquote. And then Masters finishes by saying, regarding the visitor's apparent ability to change the speed of time in the vicinity of these craft, it is interesting to note the juxtapositions between the Linda Jones and Armando Valdez case studies. As Dr. Puthoff mentioned in the first quote, quote again, if you are able to change the temporal aspect of your surrounding space, you can either speed it up or slow it down. Both options appear to have played out separately in the Jones and Valdez encounters. For example, it is apparent from Linda Jones' report that time was slowed down around them as sound shifted into the infrasonic range and she experienced a couple of hours of missing time. However, the opposite seems to have been the case with Armando Valdez, where he aged by 5 days during the 15-minute period that he was gone from his men, indicating that time moved much faster in proximity to that craft. Unquote. Now, in addition to all of this corroborating evidence suggesting that the extratempestrial model makes sense of much of what we see in these encounters, we also sometimes just have direct testimony from experiencers, even among some of the most well-known cases, and somehow this has flown under the radar. For instance, from the famous 1980 Rendlesham Forest incident in Suffolk, UK. This is what Jim Pennison was quoted as saying, quote, I've never believed that it was extraterrestrial. I still don't. We believe it, based on the evidence, it's an interdimensional type craft, and it's clearly us from the future." Unquote. And to support this further, Masters quotes from when Peniston was in a certain session with the U.S. Air Force Office of Special Investigations. Quoting from that section, quote, "During this session, Peniston spoke of being interrogated by two agents from the U.S. Air Force Office of Special Investigations and one agent from the British military, who asked if there were any beings present when he encountered the metallic craft. Peniston responded that there were visitors present, and notably that they were time travelers from the future. He reiterated that they were not extraterrestrials, but were humans coming back through time to collect genetic material to help alleviate problems they were having with reproduction in the future." And then quoting from what Peniston said, "They, the visitors, are asking me if I see binary code. I see the binary code. They are time travelers. They are us." After Peniston divulged that the visitors were future humans and not extraterrestrials, the hypnotherapist asked what they need from us. Peniston stated that they are taking gametes and sometimes fetuses to help with reproductive problems in the future. The interviewer says, "Do they ever take fetuses?" Peniston responds, "If it is tasked, they do. There are different ships for tasking. The government agents know about this. That's what they want to contain, the situation." And then Masters goes on to say, "This statement is particularly noteworthy because of its relevance to the other case studies, and most notably the previous two. For instance, Linda Jones reports having gametes and a developing fetus extracted from her person. Jones also stated that her reproductive services were very important to the visitors, beginning early in life and to a greater extent once she reached reproductive maturity. Terry Lovelace's account is also notable in this context, since he claims to have seen developing fetuses floating in a pinkish liquid inside exogenesis chambers on board a massive triangular craft. In conjunction with Peniston's above statement, this triangular ship may be an example of one that was specifically designed and built for a specific task, which in this case appears to be related to reproductive tasks. Similar to Terry Lovelace's experience, while Jim Peniston was being interrogated by agents from the U.S. Air Force Office of Special Investigations, he started to realize that the interrogators already knew about everything he was telling them, and rather than seeking information, they were simply trying to contain the situation. Their attempt at damage control also involved intentionally confusing the details of each man's account, which was done to diminish the credibility of their testimonies and to cast doubt on the reality of the event. This imposed misapprehension is revealed in Peniston's hypnotherapy session." Jumping to that again, the interviewer says, "They see you as requiring damage control?" Peniston, "Yes, they see me and John Burroughs, and they're worried about Call Halt. They know all about us." Interviewer says, "What are the intelligence agents, NSA agents, going to do with you?" Peniston replies, "They tell me when I was at the East Gate with John, they have five different stories to tell. It's important to scramble dates, which confuses and undermines consistency of eyewitness testimonies, so there's no credibility with the public and media." And then Masters continues, "In addition to revealing information about the staged cover-up, the origin of these visitors as future humans and their intent to collect gametes and genetic material from past peoples, Peniston provided an interesting and subtle detail about how these craft may physically travel back through time." Again, going to the interview. Interviewer, "Does the government believe what you are saying about them coming from the future?" Peniston, "Oh yes, this time they were having problems, but they got their machine off. They have to be in space to travel. They need speed to travel." "How far into the past can they go?" the interviewer asks. Peniston, "These ships can go 40 or 50,000 years. They can't go back much further. They might not get back." And then Masters goes on to say, "This statement corroborates a previously proposed concept related to how high-speed travel, while light cones are oriented towards the past, may allow our time-traveling descendants to venture deeper into the past. Light cones can be understood as having the same properties as light, meaning they travel at the speed of light, they propagate like light, and their trajectory can be warped and curved in the same way as light. When light cones approach an extremely large, dense, or highly energetic mass, their path becomes curved and they can tilt or tip over while still maintaining their conical shape. Remarkably, as light cones tip over in association with a warpage of proximate space-time, world lines within them can deviate from a strictly past to future linear trajectory. This means that anyone or anything traveling along a world line that lies within the margins of a tilted light cone in their localized region of space-time would now be permitted to travel into the global past via a closed time-like curve, CTC, unquote. Now, of course, there are several key revelations there that potentially support this notion of the extratempestrial model being the best explanatory mechanism to make sense of what we've seen. Again, those of you who tuned in when I covered the Terry Lovelace case will remember that he had this sense that some aspects of the military already knew about this. They already knew about his encounter and actually did their damnedest to make sure he would not remember and that his friend Toby would not remember. Again, when we think about the 90-year cover-up that we're now aware of, one wonders, is it because it's not just about space travel, but also time travel, and specifically has to do with our future? And the fact that these beings are coming back in time, beings that are genetically related to us, our very descendants even, and they're coming back to, again, address some sort of malady in our future, that perhaps there's not enough genetic variance, and so they need to come back and gather that genetic variance from their ancestors to inject new, fresh stock and to make their own stock healthier. Again, when you think about all of this, it makes a lot of sense. There's a remarkable degree of consistency and corroboration amongst these different elements and amongst the different aspects of experience or testimony over time. Again, and on top of that, we have direct statements from these others, very often saying, you are us, we are you. One time there was this case where someone said, it would be easier to deal with you if you weren't so damn ugly, basically. And the being responded by saying, my dear, one day you will look just like us. So again, often there's direct statements supporting this hypothesis if we bother to really pay attention to all of the different details and how they might work together in some overarching narrative. Now, as we begin to draw this episode to a close, I'd like now to turn to the issue of paradoxes, or at least apparent paradoxes. Again, a lot of people get caught up in the apparent paradoxes and thus reject this model, this hypothesis, this explanatory mechanism to make sense of what's been going on historically. But again, the key is that these are apparent paradoxes, only in our perception. This is what Masters has to say about that. Quote, consistency paradoxes like the grandfather paradox, as well as the causal loop paradox, aka the bootstrap paradox, where something from the future aids in its own creation by being a part of its past, despite their names, also aren't paradoxical. The common heuristic device for understanding causal loops typically involves someone creating something or having an impactful idea, which through the mechanism of backward time travel is revealed to an earlier version of themselves. This past person then uses the newly acquired information for some outcome, and later in life they become the one traveling back through time to convey that information to their younger self, in a sort of infinite self-consistent causal loop of creation and dissemination. This scenario may appear to laugh in the face of causality. However, when understood within the framework of a closed loop of self-consistent events, causality becomes irrelevant, as does the question of who created the original idea or invention taken back through time. The apparent perplexity of these scenarios largely stems from the fact that our perception of time is habitually derived from obstinate observations of linearly organized events with clearly defined boundaries between a past cause and a future effect. Yet in the presence of a time machine, events in the future can elicit an effect in the past because neither comes before the other. Unquote. So the bottom line there is that even if it's difficult for you to wrap your head around, there is no paradox here. This is a self-consistent way of thinking about the way that time works when you have something like a time machine that can manipulate our usual experience of linearity. Now, when we step back for a moment and we think about the historical narrative, the recent historical narrative, in which these beings have come into our timeline within the last century or so, perhaps going back before then, but if we just pay attention to that even, we have the sense that they're here for a reason, not just to repair some malady in their previous present, which is our future, but on top of that, they seem to be also here to warn us about a certain outcome that is inevitable based on our current trajectory, the way we exist as a civilization, and specifically the way we treat the planet, which is our home, and again, of course, ultimately will be their home as well. the messaging very often revolves around this specifically, not necessarily what's going wrong with our civilization, but what's going wrong with the planet because of the way our civilization is conducting our affairs. So in addition to being here to collect genetic material to add variants to their future population, there's also this sense that they are here to warn us, to do their best to warn us about the fact that the trajectory we are on is unsustainable and will inevitably result in a very bad outcome if we do not change our ways. Again, this has been centrally observed in so many experiencer accounts. It's old hat by now. We know what the consistent message is. It revolves around this sense of a coming cataclysm related to the way that we have a commodity-based relationship with the planet. And of course, our economic structures and whatnot also come into play there. But ultimately, there's this real focus on what we're doing to the environment, what we're doing to the planet, and the fact that our current course will lead to a bad outcome if we do not change our ways. And now I'd like to leave you with this concluding thought. When one considers the legacy of 20th century ufological history within the particular lens we've considered here today, a couple of intriguing and pertinent questions emerge. First, why would these possibly future relative beings embark on such dangerous endeavors to begin with, coming back in time and perhaps initially crashing the sophisticated space-time manipulating vehicles they're operating while working to perfect the technology? Second, why would a certain contingent of temporal locals, who are perhaps privy to what is really going on here, agree to keeping the truth of the matter secret, perhaps with a sweetener involving the receipt of some of this very sophisticated tech in the here and now? I would posit, in light of everything we've considered today, including the daunting environmental concerns the planet now faces, as well as the increasingly chaotic and self-destructive path our species seems intent on following, that perhaps the answer lies in the fact that the need is simply that dire, and that both we temporal locals and the extra-tempestrials who are in some way our future descendants have a shared interest in seeing some overarching scheme involving a newly hybrid version of the two of us somehow survive to see the light of a new day. And on that note, we've come to the close of another edition of the Point of Convergence podcast. If you'd like to support this podcast, you can do so by going to patreon.com/exoacademian. But until next time, friends, from deep within the Blue Ridge Mountains of North Carolina, this is Exoacademian signing out.